These all-nighters you keep pulling have to be unhealthy at this point. You missed Health 411 with Dr. Jonathan Carr. No worries, though. You made it just in time for your makeup appointment with The Weekend Rewind, where we play back the latest episodes of your favorite weekend talk shows. It's time to listen back to Sunday's episode of Health 411 right now, only on 107.7 The Bronx.
Doctor is in, and so are the doctors of Capital Health. Welcome to the all-new Health 411. Every Sunday morning at 10, Dr. Jonathan Karp, along with our respected panel of guests from Capital Health, take you on an important medical journey to help you navigate your health and the healthcare system to reach your destination, good health. Health 411 is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.
1077 The Bronx, 1077TheBronx.com. Proudly nominated for National Association of Broadcasters 2019, 2021, and 2022 Marconi Award for Best College Radio Station, and a recent winner of the 2023 IBS College Media Award for universities under 10,000 students. We are broadcasting from the Bronx all-digital studios on the campus of Rider University. Welcome to Health 411. I'm your host, Professor Jonathan Karp. This Health 411 program is presented by Capital Health. In Health 411, we discuss a variety of issues affecting health and wellness, public health, healthcare policy, and the science of health and healthcare. Our goal is to expand your knowledge and your perspective. Today, our student producer and I, Dan Geller, are going to expand your knowledge and perspective by talking about hemophilia and some recent advances in gene therapy that is involved with the treatment of hemophilia. And Dan, you picked this topic, did you not?
I did pick this topic.
And what inspired you to want to talk about hemophilia and gene therapy treatments for that disease?
So the way that they're treating this hemophilia now, or at least in this clinical trial, the way they did it, it's pretty fascinating, the mechanism of it and exactly how it's different from like something normal, like taking an antibiotic, for example.
Well, let's take a step back and let's talk about, because you don't want to jump right in and just talk about things and not bring everybody up to speed to where you are. So if we're going to talk about hemophilia, what is hemophilia?
Hemophilia is a blood clotting disorder. It's issues with blood clotting.
Is it just one disorder?
No, it's a group of disorders. There's this specific one that we're going to talk
about
today.
Well, in general, right? But start big. Mm-hmm. So hemophilia has sometimes been called like one of the royal diseases. Right? Like Habsburg head.
Yeah, the Habsburg chin or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. So it's a collection of diseases or disorders that are involved with blood clotting. Where do they come from?
What do you mean, where do they come from? Oh, well, they're like a lot of diseases, like the basis for it is in the genetic code.
Okay, so these are genetic disorders and they're involved with blood clotting. So what happens to people who have hemophilia?
They can't clot as well. Well, let's say you get a cut, it's not going to clot as quickly. You might bleed more, sort of thing. Can lead to issues with iron, anemia. I believe hemophilia can lead to anemia.
Yeah, it can. I mean, any blood loss can lead to kinds of anemia. But blood loss and the problems related to that, my understanding is not necessarily the major problems in hemophilia, is that the idea is, in order for you to clot a cut if you had it, but also in order for you just to heal in terms of normal motion, normal things that we just do, like, you know, apparently there's like micro tears from, you know, working out, joint movement, muscle tears, all that kind of stuff. And normally your body just, or even bruises, your body just sort of clots it and eventually stops the blood loss and you heal. People with hemophilia have these different reasons for why they don't clot normally, and it leads to problems within the realm of the. I remember I, this is, you're making me have flashbacks when you suggested the topic, because when I was an undergraduate, just like I'm sure they do now in, you know, physiology classes, you have to learn like all those steps that are involved in blood
clotting. I haven't learned those, but I do know of them.
I remember being in class, some classes as a college student, and hating learning that stuff because all these factors had numbers and they don't go from like one to something. Anyway, eventually when you clot, you get, you know, some sort of fibrin cross-linked blood clot. But people who have some genetic anomalies in their genetic code, some of these clotting factors are not made. And when these clotting factors are not made, clots don't form normally. Mm-hmm. Bleeding doesn't stop. And people have blood clotting issues. And collectively, they're known as hemophilia, mm-hmm. right? Are we talking about treatments for all of these things?
No, specifically this was for hemophilia A.
Now what does it mean? What is hemophilia A?
So hemophilia A is... the issue with this specific type of hemophilia is something called factor 8, one of the blood clotting factor, mm-hmm. factor proteins, factor 8. And I'm not sure if it has to do with the conformation of the protein or exactly what aspect of it, but in some way it's abnormal. And so that leads to the blood clotting issues.
Yeah, so an abnormal protein, it could either not be made or it could be made in folds not properly. So it's an... You know, it doesn't do its job. It's mm-hmm. not folded properly, so it can connect to other things. So hemophilia A is patients with it are missing clotting factor 8. Hemophilia A is the most common kind of hemophilia, mm-hmm. but there's other kind of hemophilia too.
So hemophilia B, C, D.
Yeah. Well, hemophilia A. I saw numbers that said it's something like 80% of people.
Yeah, it is the most common one, significantly.
And I think about 15% or so of people have something called hemophilia B.
I don't know. I actually don't know the difference between the two.
Well, hemophilia B is their missing clotting factor 9.
Okay, so does it basically always have to do with which clotting factor is abnormal?
Yeah, those are the two most common kinds of hemophilia. There's other kinds of bleeding disorders like, von Willebrand disease. That has to do with the ability of platelets to sort of interact in part of the cascade. A lot of people have that. There is a hemophilia C. Both hemophilia A and hemophilia B are interesting because my understanding is that they're both single gene disorders.
Mm-hmm. Right? They are.
So there's single gene disorders that make sort of a therapeutic approach at least conceptually a little easier. I'm not going to say easier to do, but if you're only targeting a certain kind of cell that makes these clotting factors. Good question, Dan. What cells in the body? Where are these clotting factors made?
Liver cells, hepatocytes.
Yes and no. Clotting factor 9 for hemophilia B is made in hepatocytes. I don't think hepatocytes make clotting factor 8. I think it's endothelial cells of the liver that actually make it.
Okay.
So liver cells, yes.
But not hepatocytes.
Not hepatocytes.
Okay. Gotcha.
I think, there's some hepatic endothelial cells that make clotting factor 8. But that's still interesting. People still know where it come from. And these are things in the cascade of events, you know, A to B to C, that has to be involved in order for prothrombin to make thrombin and for thrombin to cause fibrinogen to make a fibrin cross-linked blood clot.
A lot of fancy steps.
Well, it's
just, you know, for a blood clot.
People have been studying this thing for a very, very long time. But what happens is if you're missing some of these factors, if you're missing factor 8 or factor 9, which leads to most hemophilia, most people, it's sort of measured in terms of severity. Normal people to have normal blood clotting. But then if you looked at the levels of factor 8 or factor 9 that are in the blood, if you are somewhere between 5 and 40% of normal levels, you have what's called mild hemophilia. 1 to 5%, it's moderate hemophilia.
1 to 5.
1 is, yeah, 1. Like
okay.
One,
yeah.
one digit.
Yes.
To 5%. It's moderate hemophilia. Severe hemophilia happens. People have low levels below 1% of these normal clotting factors. So in order for you to have hemophilia, the levels of at least these things have to go down pretty far to have this clotting disease. There's single gene disorders. What's interesting about them is there something interesting about the genetics of hemophilia?
Yeah, so it's by sequencing the genome, we can see exactly where in the genome the problem is.
You're getting too much detail. I'm just saying, is hemophilia Y-linked? Is it X-linked? How is hemophilia interesting? And who tends to get hemophilia?
I think men.
Okay,
so I believe it's a Y-linked disorder.
Okay,
I might be wrong.
Yes, you would be, because it's actually an X-linked disorder, right? And so if it's an X-linked disorder, it means that females are usually carriers and can pass it on, but males, if they only get one
mutant X, they'll be affected.
They're going to be affected. And so it's one of these royal diseases. I think Queen Victoria of England was known to be a carrier and passed it. I think she had something like 8 or 9 grandchildren and passed it on. I think like 3 of them died of this through her bloodline. You ever heard of Rasputin?
I have. It's a famous guy.
A famous guy in Russia. So I think the Tsar Nicholas II, the last Tsar's wife, they had a child who was killed by the Bolsheviks, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But he had hemophilia, and the mother brought in Rasputin as sort of a faith healer to try to, you know, magically heal the child. And we don't know because I guess they were all shot.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence that it would have worked anyway. So the point is that there are consequences, and there's a history of hemophilia having an effect on how people live their lives and stuff like that, even famous people. And as you hinted at, this is sort of a disorder that is sort of linked to breeding of people.
Yeah.
Some of the royal people were breeding with their first cousins and stuff. And
right.
But that does not mean that everybody who has hemophilia is involved with inbreeding.
No, of course not. I mean, the inbreeding just makes it more common, like every other disease.
Well it just makes it more interesting to think about. But if you meet somebody with hemophilia, you can't accuse them or their family members of inbreeding. And because people know about the genetic mutation and what causes it, where the cells are, it's sort of one of the things that's sort of ripe for investigating for gene therapy. And we'll come back after some underwriting announcements, and we'll talk about how that works. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronc and 107.7thebronc.com.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronc and 107.7thebronc.com. We are recording Health 411 from the Digital Bronc Studios. Welcome back. Dan and I are having a conversation today about gene therapy or potential gene therapy to help treat hemophilia. Hemophilia is a blood clotting disorder where, because of generic inborn errors of metabolism, they say, certain cells in your liver do not make some of the factors that are needed to form a blood clot. And as a result of that, anybody who has a fall or an injury or gets cut could like bleed to death, not clot, and have a lot of, you know, movement, joint problems, and a lot of problems like that. But we're not talking about, we're not going to focus on hemophilia per se, just to provide some background. We're going to talk about the potential gene therapy of these things. So what is that? Explain to me what's going on.
So gene therapy.
Well, I'm going to take a step back, just in the terms of concept. How is hemophilia traditionally treated now? Because it's not like there was nothing available to help.
Yeah, so traditionally, I believe that it was sort of with infusions they treated it. They would try to infuse this clotting factor into you, and that didn't work so well.
Well, it does work.
It works.
But it's inconvenient to have to get these infusions.
Sort of like dialysis. Like, you don't want to be sitting and getting infusions every week.
People that get these infusions, so you get if people have identified these factors that your body doesn't make, if they know what they are and you can engineer them, you can infuse them into people. And sort of, I mean, the treatments have gotten much better. I've seen reports that, you know, even as late as the 1950s and 1960s, people who had hemophilia died like by their 30s or something like that. Now, people with hemophilia, because of advances in treatments and care, people live, I think they said, you know, into their 70s. So the life expectancy is only like 10 years or so from what it is for people without hemophilia. And those treatments are we can't say they don't work because they do work. They're pretty good.
So
at allowing people to live full lives.
So this gene therapy stuff is a little bit beneficial because it doesn't rely, at least after the initial infusion, it doesn't rely on an external source to get these proteins into your body.
Right.
Because it's actually changing your gene sequence.
Well,
The idea, at least.
The idea is, theoretically, instead of having to go every so often to do these things, because if you just put the factor in, it's going to be metabolized over time at sort of a constant rate. And at some point, you put enough in, you're above the therapeutic threshold, but it's going to come down, and just over time, you're going to go below the therapeutic threshold. You're going to, again, have trouble clotting and all that kind of stuff, and usually you're at a very, very high risk. You have to do another infusion.
Mm-hmm.
The idea behind this gene therapy is you can go in there and put cells in.
Sort of attack the problem at its source.
There's two different kinds of gene therapy. There's in vivo gene therapy and ex vivo gene therapy. So what are we talking about here?
Here, I'm not sure about the difference between those two words.
Okay, let me explain it before you run off. So there's one kind of gene therapy that says we're going to take cells out of an affected patient. We're going to put them in a petri dish. We are going to do things to them, which we'll explain, that will change their genetic code, and then we'll put them back into you.
Mm-hmm.
That's like ex vivo. In vivo gene therapy means we're going to infuse things into you. Those things are going to go find the cells they need to find and insert the correct genetic material into those cells. And then if you do that just right, now the cells that are in you, in your liver in this case, will take over and start making the correct protein, because DNA makes RNA, makes protein. And if you fix the protein sequence now, even though you were born with a defective gene for making a certain protein or a certain factor in this case, those cells will...
They'll function as they need to work.
Well, they work before too, but they'll work and they'll create the correct things that your body needs.
Yes.
So this is a kind of what's called in vivo, in the body gene therapy, which is a different kind than you take cells out, you putz with them and put them back in, right? But in either case, you need, what's critical to understand how this works, you need a delivery system.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the delivery system that we're talking about here for hemophilia, and how does it work?
Here, it's a virus. They're using something called an adeno-associated virus, and essentially they put in the correct sequence into the virus. Virus goes into the body, into the liver, and it inserts that sequence.
Okay, so take a step back. When you say they insert a DNA sequence, what are they inserting it into?
A vein. I believe they're
they're inserting it into the virus. You said the virus, right? And the virus is basically just like a...
It's a vector. It's a vector.
And what does that mean, vector?
Something that carries the drug to where it needs to go.
So you have like this caspid-like thing.
Yes.
This outer coat of the virus, right? Don't viruses make people sick?
Yeah, but this is a special type of virus that doesn't do that. Because think about the way that normal viruses make you sick. They attach...
Normal viruses
make you sick by attaching onto your cell, injecting genetic material, and then that genetic material builds more viruses. Viruses break out of the cell, go infect more cells. That's how normal viruses do it.
Okay.
This virus does the same thing, except the genetic code it carries isn't for more viruses. It's for a treatment of hemophilia.
Correct. So you've basically taken this virus, adeno-associated virus... Right, someone AAV, right? And you've removed the virus part that would call like a adenovirus infection. And you've put in sort of like the genetic code for like human factor 8 for hemophilia A, correct?
Yes.
And then so you infuse what, when you read about it, sound like a ginormous amount of this stuff, but you infuse this stuff IV into a patient.
It's actually a really small amount.
What was that amount?
The amount was, I think, 6.3 times 10 to the 13th VG. What is VG?
My guess is that's the viral genomes.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Something like that.
So yeah, that's 6 times 10 to the 13th. That's 6 with 13 zeros. That's a lot of genomes.
Yes.
Yeah, so per kilogram, especially.
Per kilogram of body weight of the patient. So if you had, let's say, 150 kilogram person, I guess that's still sort of big, but you know what I mean.
It's a lot of genomes.
It's still viruses are very small. They're smaller than cells. And how do these viruses, these adeno-associated viruses, know to find cells in the liver, hepatocytes and endothelial cells in the liver, and not like skin cells or myocardiocytes or, you know, other kinds of cells in your body.
I'm not sure like exactly what's going on with that, but I think that they inject it into you, and that blood that is carrying the virus is eventually going to go to the liver.
But right, it's eventually going to go everywhere.
It's eventually going to go everywhere. Right. So maybe there's some sort of special condition in the liver that tells the virus, hey, latch onto these cells.
So if I said to you something like a liver specific promoter,
yes,
what does that mean to you?
A region of DNA specifically found in the liver that this sequence is specific is attenuated to. Right. I don't know if attenuated is the right word, but
no, attenuated means like generating like less of a response.
Okay.
So what is part of what the genetic information that they're putting into this viral particle that's going to go find liver cells? They use some sort of liver specific promoter such that only the liver cells will incorporate and ingest, so to speak, even though the virus is sort of injecting it in there, this virus delivery system, only the cells of interest in this case. So your brain cells aren't going to start making
that could be a problem.
Your muscle cells are not going to get infected. And so a lot of this stuff had to be worked out, which is the adeno-associated virus is a, say common, but a relatively common delivery system for delivering therapeutic medicines or genetic material to things, even for like hemophilia B, which preceded the stuff that we're talking about now with hemophilia A. The hemophilia B, there was actually a medicine approved by the FDA in November of 2022 for that.
Is that a monoclonal antibody? Because that's what they were using before.
It was Hemgenix, which is no. It was a treatment that worked on this same sort of way that hemophilia A treatment that we're talking about.
Okay.
But it worked for hemophilia B, which was factor 9, which is a smaller gene.
So it was maybe a little easier, even though
fewer people have hemophilia B, the gene was a smaller gene, so it was sort of easier to target. The paper now that you picked with hemophilia A, the gene for hemophilia for factor 8 is just a bigger,
it's a bigger sequence.
Gene, so
yeah.
It's a little bit more difficult, I guess, technology to make it or whatever it is. We should say
the name of this treatment, that what it was actually called. It's a weird name. I think it's pronounced valactocogene roxaparvovec.
Roxaparvovec is what they're calling it. Therapy for hemophilia A. And a pharmaceutical company is putting this out. You know what's really interesting about reading the paper too is like, you know, it's like so different than academia with these pharmaceutical companies. They had a professional writer like write the first draft of these papers.
So all the
scientists have to do is sit there and edit it and all this sort of. It's unbelievable that having to like create these. It's the hardest. I am the master of the unfinished manuscript because I don't like writing so much. If I had a professional writer to do this,
I would have
published much more than I ever have or ever will. But anyway, so what here is they have this vector with the human genetic information to make factor 8 that they're going to infuse into patients. Mm-hmm. Now, who were the patients that they picked?
I think it was like roughly 18-year-old men who were severely affected.
Oh, people older than 18.
Older than 18,
adults. And they had 134 men, and they're calling that who had severe hemophilia.
And so that means less than 1% of the functional gene products you need, so factor 8.
Correct. So these are bleeders. They're potential bleeders. So these are adults. They're 18 or older. Are they untreated up to this point?
I believe that all of these patients had been previously treated with monoclonal antibodies in the current standard of treatment.
Which is the factor 8 infusions every so often. And that's so they've made it to 18, they get these infusions all the time. But they sort of volunteered for this clinical trial where a viral vector that's going to deliver theoretically a corrected genetic code sequence to their liver, and hopefully their livers will start making factor eight. And that's sort of the idea behind this. We will come back and we will explore sort of what happened after we take a break for some underwriting announcements. We'll be right back with Health 411. You are listening to 1077 The Bronc and 1077thebronc.com.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronc, 1077thebronc.com. Welcome back to Health 411. I'm Professor Jonathan Karp, and I have a conversation with Dan Geller, and we are discussing hemophilia, and we're discussing a study that he wanted to talk about, hemophilia, where they infused adeno-associated virus with human factor VIII genetic information into people. These were people who had severe hemophilia, so they were making less than 1% of the normal factor VIII that they need for blood clotting. This was also a phase 3 study.
So what's the difference between phase 1, 2, and 3?
There's all, yes, phase 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's important to know. What is the difference between phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3?
I assume phase 1 would be like the very early stage clinical trials, and phase 4 is more like the broadest ones, where it's maybe more available to the general public.
Yep, you're close. So stage one or phase one trials are basically small trials of under 50 people, and they do a treatment and they basically want to say, is this thing safe?
Mm-hmm. Just so safe.
Is it just safe? Small number of people. Then if everything clicks and everything's good, they'll do phase two trials. Phase two trials are usually, I guess less than 100 patients or so, and they want to look for side effects. They want to look for some efficacy, like, does it even work? Mm-hmm. Like, first, it's just, is it safe? Then, what are the side effects? Does it work? That's phase two. This is phase three. Phase three clinical trials are those that basically use like 100 or a couple hundred people, and you want to basically say, is this treatment as good or better than the existing treatments are out there? So in this case, the existing treatments are the infusions, mm-hmm. or stuff like that to try to replace the missing factor for blood clotting that sometimes happens. Phase four, which would come next after phase three, is basically making it, it's when thousands of people get it, and it's actually used to treat. Mm-hmm. So that's the final.
We're currently at phase three with this.
This is phase three, yes. Which sort of makes sense. So they had a 134 volunteers of men with severe hemophilia, right? And they received a single infusion, a 6 times 10 to the 13 vector genomes of the valactogene roxaparvovec per kilogram of body weight.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that very often.
VR.
VR. It just came out, right? And so they received this thing. Okay, this infusion. Like,
what did it do?
Yeah, like what happened? How do you want to talk about it? For people listening, how do you want to set up what do they do with this?
I mean, sort of. So let's talk about like what people are experiencing with the baseline without this treatment. Baseline, 30% of this group of people had no bleeding events for the year. 30%.
Okay, set this up. What do people who are even being treated with the conventional treatments for hemophilia? What's sort of the baseline sort of normal thing for hemophilia?
For hemophilia?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it says in the paper.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, that 30% had no bleeding events.
Well, no, those are people who...
So 70% did have bleeding events.
No, these people who got the viral therapy were people who are getting like traditional treatments.
Yeah, so that's what this is talking about.
Okay,
I think if you look at further down in Figure A,
I will go to Figure like A. You tell me.
Page 700.
Okay, you tell me.
Yeah,
you
so the baseline for no bleeding events was 30%. So 70% had some sort of bleeding event.
Okay.
And then no treated bleeding events was 32% of people. And no treated bleeding joint events was 40% of people. So that's sort of the baseline. Most people are having some sort of issue throughout the year with their bleeding, be that from just spontaneous bleeding, you have to treat it, or something with the joints.
Yes.
Do you see?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I don't need to see it. I want you to explain it to somebody listening on the radio will understand.
And then we have, for the first year post-treatment, it went up to 58% of people had no sort of bleeding events. And it was even better when we're talking about bleeding events that needed treatment. That was more like 80% or 88%.
So
It certainly seems like superficially that this did what it was supposed to do.
Well, yes. So. I would suggest that instead of saying things, I would suggest putting it this way. They calculated something called the mean annual bleeding rate, right? So there's a baseline bleeding rate that people get when they're being treated with infusions of factor VIII, people with hemophilia A, severe people, right? What they say here is the annualized bleeding rate decreased by over 80% from baseline among the people who had the infusion. Right,
mm-hmm.
And that happened within within the first about yearish that they were following these people. In this paper, they followed them. It looks like for a little over 2 years, right?
Yes.
And it looks like even afterwards, after 2 years of this. Right, the 95% like confidence interval for the decrease, it's very, very highly. No, it doesn't mean that everybody worked in the same way. There's still some variability, but it decreased the bleeding rate by over 80%, which is pretty big.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a big factor. Were there side effects? Were there problems with this?
I don't think there were many side effects. Certainly better than what was what the normal treatment was. I think there was some cases of spontaneous bleeding, headache, nausea, sort of the normal stuff you have when you're taking a new medication. Did you see anything specific?
Well, no. What I'm trying to get you to to address is the idea that this seems like a relatively, even after so a single infusion, following it up for about 2 years, it looks like the incorporation of this DNA into the liver seems to be working, and people's own bodies started taking over. They stopped having to get their own infusions, right? After, I think, like 20-something weeks into the study, they stopped treating normally. And then the factor VIII continued to be in their body. And the factor VIII sort of showed normal characteristics of, like, removal, bioavailability, first-order kinetics they talked about. So it looks like even 2 years post-infusion, it looks like that these people's livers have taken over and have started making their own factor VIII. And along with that is that there were some side effects like nausea and vomiting and blah, 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 but those things were relatively mild and it only happened in a small number of patients. You're nodding, but I'm, you know... Is that sort of what was in the paper?
Yeah.
Cool. And that is really, really cool. And what's interesting in addition to that is that there were a couple, what might you expect if you have liver cells that are being infused or sort of infected or being delivered with this new genetic material, right? Did they have a way of seeing if there was any liver toxicity going on?
Yeah, so they said that the most common adverse event in terms of like chemical levels was elevated alanine aminotransferase.
What is that?
I don't know what
that
is.
You didn't look it up?
I did not look it up.
Did you ever look at a blood test?
I've never looked at a blood test.
Oh, the result? Oh, blood test? Okay. So one way that sort of liver health is assessed is measuring alanine aminotransferase levels. If those levels go very, very high, it's generally a clinical sign of some sort of liver damage. I guess like in old people like me, they look like at alanine aminotransferase and other liver enzymes to see how your liver is doing, to tell you you should drink less and exercise more and all that kind of stuff.
Stuff they always tell you.
It's one of those things. And some of the people did have, they said the most common adverse event were transient levels in alanine aminotransferase, which I suspect they do say they treated with some immunosuppressive therapy. In this case, I think they probably used the some sort of glucocorticoid.
That's what they said. Yeah.
They used some, and I forget the name of it, one of them. I'm in the pee bucket. But they did some and it was transient. They treated with glucocorticoid therapy. And in a sense, I wasn't surprised by that because I would think that if liver cells are having genetic material injected into them, like the liver, that there would be some response to these cells some sort of signal that, hey, things aren't right for a while.
So
and it's picked up as sort of a distress signal in the blood.
Does increased levels of this kind of automatically mean that cells are being harmed, like they're being broken open, or what is it exactly that,
that's
a response
a good question.
To?
I don't know. I do know it's a pretty standard measure of liver health.
Okay.
And levels are not supposed to be like super, super high.
Yeah.
So if your liver cells are like screaming, I'm not happy, they're going to release alanine aminotransferase. Kinds of thing. And so that was a pretty relatively minor kind of thing. So I have a question for you just if the end of this segment. So we are talking about giving patients, male patients over 18, sort of genetic material that's been put into a virus. And we're talking about an inherited disease, right? Are these, you know, people who theoretically may be cured now, because it looks like their bone bodies may be, it's only 2 years, they're going to keep monitoring these people a bit, are they going to have an above a therapeutic level of factor eight? Does that mean they're no longer going to be carriers for the disease and no longer be able to pass on hemophilia to their offspring?
No.
Hold that thought, because we're running out of time for this segment. And we'll answer that question after some underwriting announcements. You're listening to 1077 The Bronc and 1077 The Bronc Doctor.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronc, 1077TheBronc.com. Welcome back to Health 411 from the Digital Bronx Studios. Dan and I have a conversation about hemophilia A and treating hemophilia A with a viral vector in search of corrected genetic information. And given that hemophilia is an X-linked genetic disorder, females can have it, but usually males who are affected because they won't have a copy of a healthy X chromosome. I asked the question at the end of the last segment. If this treatment seems to work and it's infused and somebody who has the disorder and is not making factor X, if you insert factor X into their liver cells and now they're making, I'm not factor X, factor eight, it works on factor X and that big long cascade. So it's all muddled in my brain. I told you never
yeah,
liked this stuff.
I gotcha.
If they start making factor eight, does this mean they're no longer capable of passing along the defective gene?
So let's talk about like the disease is rooted in the genetic code, right? And the way this treats it is by putting in a new piece of genetic code. So you might think that, okay, yeah, my kids will also have this new genetic code. But it's all about the germline cells. It's all about your sperm cells or your egg cells. That's what's going to be carrying the disorder to your progeny. And so it's sort of like asking, if I cut my arm off, will my kid have no arm? No, because that the issue isn't with my sperm. The issue is with my arm.
Correct. So in this case, even if this cure seems to work, and it looks like this is very promising, it doesn't look like it's working with minimum side effects, because these patients were able to discontinue their infusions of factor eight that they had to go everywhere. It looks like after a couple of years, this is just a phase three trial. It doesn't mean that they're not carriers, right? Their germline, their sperm, those females, their eggs, could still be carriers because these have a, like we talked about, a liver-specific promoter. So the idea that only in the liver cells would this fixed genetic material be working.
But I wonder if there would be a way to sort of do gene therapy on the germline cells and fix your actual like meiosis. So that
I think there's some the ethical concerns are higher with that because
significantly.
You're changing the genetic code of cells that aren't using the genetic code at that time.
Mm-hmm.
At least if you're getting cells that are using that portion of the DNA sequence, you know that it has to be uncoiled. You know, the histones have to be uncoiled. All that stuff has to happen good enough to get it in there to incorporate it. I don't know if the coiling is so tight in the germline that wouldn't happen. But it's an interesting question. I'm sure people are sort of looking at that.
You can also see the effects of this, like, right away. Like, well, not right away, but in a relatively short time span as opposed to, like...
Weeks.
Weeks. As opposed to, like, a sperm cell, like, you have to wait for the kid to be a kid to see any effects.
Yeah. So what they say here... that they looked 4 weeks and 6 weeks after their infusion. So that's when they started to see the incorporation and taking over. So, if 4 to 6 weeks kinds of stuff like that is when they sort of start to see, do their measurements. Apparently, they took some measurements within 72 hours after the infusion, but they didn't include them in the data. So, who knows what was going on there. What was really, there's a lot of interesting things with this because, like I said, the side effects were very, very small. We talked about the baseline values of people with hemophilia who are even getting their infusion. They compared their results to published epidemiological data from people with hemophilia A. And like I said, this is like big ass positive results, which is one reason the paper came out in the New England Journal of Medicine. If you wanted to look at it, it came out in 2023 in volume 388. It's actually page 694 if you want to look it up and see it. But this kind of therapy has the potential to really, really help people as they're following this up.
I do wonder though. So the paper article is called 2-year outcomes of valactacogene roxaparvovec therapy for hemophilia A. Just put that out there. But I wonder how it was after 2 years, maybe 5 years, 10 years down the line.
Well, only time will tell.
But that's interesting.
It is interesting because it looks like this is the kind of thing that they have to monitor. They have to see what it goes.
Because once the gene is in the code, right? Like once you successfully use this vector, why would it go away? Why wouldn't the liver cells just keep dividing with that new genetic code?
Well, that's
the question.
That's the point.
Yeah.
And that's why they looked at it in terms of what is the future factor VIII activity that they're going to predict down the line, which is why they looked at all the kinetics starting a little over a year, so 76 weeks into it. And it looks like their model suggests that factor VIII is going to be produced. And you remember, these people had very, very severe. They were making less than 1% of, sort of normal levels. They're looking at, if you could just make severe hemophilia to moderate or mild, that's a big improvement. And then they can tweak some of the things and they talk about some of the individual factors because not everybody responded. There were a couple non-responders. I think it was less than 5% of the non-responders. But it means something was going on in these people that that made them a little bit different.
Yeah.
Here it is. At year two, that, I'll just read it. After 2 years, 4.5%, 9.1%, and 58% of the participants had severe, moderate, or mild hemophilia, and almost 27% had normal factor VIII levels.
Yeah.
So even though they had all these people with severe hemophilia, it seemed like most of the people were helped a little bit, but not everybody was pushed above the things. At 2 years, it looks like, if you look at like 80% of the people either had normal or mild normal levels of factor VIII or mild hemophilia now. We're still looking at 13% who had moderate or severe hemophilia. It's better than 100% having severe.
Yeah.
So there are some factors that have to be worked out. It could be viral genome dose.
Mm-hmm.
It could be other factors about the people, smoking, drug and alcohol. Who knows?
Disorders that we don't know that they had. Something else. Yeah.
Right. And they tried, whenever you do these clinical trials,
It's hard to really control for that one thing, isn't it?
Well, and you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And it could be other health concerns, alcohol use in the liver. All they tried to eliminate as many people had these things as possible getting in there. But like I said, no safety, no new safety or problems happened. Anything new as far as 2 years. Other than that, elevated alanine aminotransferase levels that happened in a lot of people, which I guess they knew to look at because you're actually tweaking their liver and the liver's responding by, sending out some signals.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the extrapolated. So from week 104, so how many years is 104 weeks?
There are 52 weeks in a year, dude.
Okay, so 2 years.
If you double it, that's 2 years.
2 years. So from 2 years to 260 weeks. So they predicted, so the mean for 2 years was 22.3 IU per deciliter, okay, of the factor eight. Normal levels range from 50 to 150. That's a normal level. So they were operating about, I don't know, 50%, give or take, of what normal is.
Okay.
And then when you come out to, what, 4 years, 5 years, it's down to 11.8, so half of that. But I still think that's better than the 1%, which would be like, what, 0.5 IU per deciliter that they were dealing with without therapy.
Yeah, and right, but it remains to be seen. Remember, those are just, mathematical projections. It remains to be seen, is one infusion enough? Maybe if you did two infusions, enough liver cells would be infected.
Or if you go down to almost baseline after a few years, just do the injection again, see if it fixes it.
Infusion, yeah, right. So
infusion, yeah.
Those are some of the subtle details that science will work out, but the conceptual part about this that is actually cool, is it's a real life example of changing the genome in which somebody was born with to fix a problem. You know, in case factor that was being, blood clotting factor that was being made. Are there other examples of this kind of, you know, adeno-associated virus being used to help people?
No, I mean, I don't have any specific examples in mind, but I'm sure that there are a lot of diseases that could benefit from this. I mean, we know cancer, for example, is an issue with the genetic code, so maybe you
not,
could...
Not always.
Not always, but it can be.
Right? Sometimes cancer could be something you inherit, but cancer could all be also be environmental.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's environmental, though, like smoking, let's say, it's the carcinogenicity of the chemicals that are changing your code.
But is it a single gene?
No, it's definitely not a single
so
gene.
So is cancer, I instead of cancer in the big envelope, or would you want to talk about a specific kind?
Is there single gene cancer?
That's what you'd have to find. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you could find a cancer that it was known to be a mutation in a single gene, that would be a great thing. Or if you could find a,
I don't think there really is any single gene that will cause cancer. Even if it's in multiple genes, maybe you can get multiple AAVs, multiple of these viruses.
That would
multiple.
Be an interesting idea.
This is all the future.
So I'm sure people are looking at ways to deliver more than one genetic sequence to the cells at a time, like putting multiple in an adeno-associated virus. That seems like too straightforward.
Yeah.
not for somebody to be looking at kinds of stuff.
Nanobots, maybe.
But anyway, using these, you know, viral vectors for gene delivery is a very, very hot area of research. And these adeno-associated viruses are one of the standard bearers of that technology. I remember when even they were being investigated, but now they seem relatively common in delivery because they've been deemed necessarily safe. Right? Cool. We're running out of time, dude.
We are.
You got to give me the signal. So this is the end of our program. This is 107.7 The Bronc, 107.7thebronc.com. We're recording Health 411 live from the Digital Bronx Studios. Thank you for listening. This program is part of Capital Health and Rider University's efforts to bring people together to address issues associated with all aspects of health and healthcare. We hope today's conversation that Dan and I are having is giving you some things to think about the future of hemophilia and the possibility that it can be treated with viral vectors, fixing DNA sequences in human cells. If you have questions and or comments about this program or want to make suggestions for future broadcasts, please email us at health411. At rider.edu.
Remember, you have a doctor's appointment scheduled for every Sunday at 10 a.m. Don't miss the all-new Health 411 with Dr. Jonathan Karp and our expert medical guest from Capital Health. You can listen to Health 411 anytime on demand. Go to 1077thebronc.com/health411 to listen to past episodes or tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. to hear the weekend rewind edition of Health 411. Health 411 on 1077 The Bronc is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.